Chapter 9. Got a gown on again, and a wig of white hair on his head, and he is sitting with other dervishes in a great room full of them, and on the throne in the middle is an old sultan in scarlet, sitting before a desk, and he wears a wig too, and the young man gets up, and speaks to him. And now what is here? He is in a room with ever so many children, and the miniature hanging up. Can it be a likeness of that woman who is sitting before that copper urn, with a silver vase in her hand, from which she is pouring hot liquor in two cups? Was she ever a fairy? She is as fat as a hippopotamus now. He is sitting on a divan by the fire. He has a paper on his knees. Read the name of the paper. It is the Superfine Review. It inclines to think that Mr. Dickens is not a true gentleman, that Mr. Thackeray is not a true gentleman, and that when the one is pert, and the other is arch, we, the gentlemen of the Superfine Review, think, and think rightly, that we have some cause to be indignant. The great cause why modern humor and modern sentimentalism repel us, is that they are unwarrantably familiar. Now, Mr. Sterne, the Superfine Reviewer thinks, was a true sentimentalist, because he was above all things a true gentleman. The flattering inference is obvious. Let us be thankful for having an elegant moralist watching over us, and learn, if not too old, to imitate his high-bred politeness and catch his unobtrusive grace. If we are unwarrantably familiar, we know who is not. If we repel by pertness, we know who never does. If our language offends, we know whose is always modest. Oh, pity! The vision has disappeared off the silver, the images of youth and the past are vanishing away. We who have lived before railways were made, belong to another world. In how many hours could the Prince of Wales drive from Brighton to London, with a light carriage built expressly, and relays of horses longing to gallop the next stage? Do you remember, Sir Somebody, the coachman of the age, who took our half-crown so affably? It was only yesterday, but what a gulf between now and then. Then was the old world. Stage coaches, more or less swift, riding horses, pack horses, highwaymen, knights in armor, Norman invaders, Roman legions, druids, ancient Britons painted blue, and so forth, all these belong to the old period. I will concede a halt in the midst of it, and allow that gunpowder and printing tended to modernize the world. But the railroad starts the new era, and we of a certain age belong to the new time and the old one. We are of the time of chivalry as well as the Black Prince or Sir Walter Manny. We are of the age of steam. We have stepped out of the old world onto Brunel's vast deck, and across the waters engines pad it tell us. Towards what new continent are we wending? To what new laws, new manners, new politics, vast new expanses of liberties unknown as yet, or only surmised? I used to know a man who had invented a flying machine. He would say, give me but £500, and I will make it. It is so simple of construction, that I tremble daily lest some other person should light upon and patent my discovery. Perhaps faith was wanting, perhaps the £500. He is dead, and somebody else must make the flying machine. But that will only be a step forward on the journey already begun, since we quitted the old world. There it lies on the other side of yonder embankments. You young folks have never seen it, and Waterloo is to you no more than a Jinkert, and George IV, than Sardanapalus. We elderly people have lived in that pre-railroad world, which has passed into limbo and vanished from under us. I tell you it was firm under our feet once, and not long ago. They have raised those railroad embankments up, and shut off the old world that was behind them. Climb up that bank on which the irons are laid, and look to the other side, it is gone. There is no other side. Try and catch yesterday. Where is it? Here is a Times newspaper, dated Monday 26th, and this is Tuesday 27th. Suppose you deny there was such a day as yesterday? We who lived before railways, and survive out of the ancient world, are like Father Noah and his family out of the ark. The children will gather round, and say to us patriarchs, tell us, grandpapa about the old world, and we shall mumble our old stories, and we shall drop off one by one, and there will be fewer and fewer of us, and he's very old and feeble. There will be but 10 Prerolroadites left. Then 3, then 2, then 1, then 0. If the hippopotamus had the least sensibility, of which I cannot trace any signs either in his hide or his face, I think he would go down to the bottom of his tank, and never come up again. Does he not see that he belongs to bygone ages, and that his great hulking barrel of a body is out of place in these times? What has he in common with the brisk young life surrounding him? In the watches of the night, when the keepers are asleep, when the birds are on one leg, when even the little armadillo is quiet, and the monkeys have ceased their chatter, the hippopotamus, and the elephant, and the long-necked giraffe, perhaps may lay their heads together, and have a colloquy about the great silent antediluvian world which they remember, where mighty monsters floundered through the ooze, crocodiles be asked on the banks, and dragons darted out of the caves, and waters before men were made to slay them. We who lived before railways are antediluvians, we must pass away. We are growing scarcer every day, and old, very old relics of the times, when George was still fighting the dragon. Not long since, a company of horse riders paid a visit to our watering place. We went to see them, and I bethought me that young Walter Juvenis, who was in the place, might like also to witness the performance. A pantomime is not always amusing to persons who have attained a certain age, but a boy at a pantomime is always amused and amusing, and to see his pleasure is good for most hypochondriacs. We sent to Walter's mother, requesting that he might join us, and the kind lady replied that the boy had already been at the morning performance of the equestrians, but was most eager to go in the evening likewise. And go he did, and laughed at all Mr. Merriman's remarks, though he remembered them with remarkable accuracy, and insisted upon waiting to the very end of the fun, and was only induced to retire just before its conclusion by representations that the ladies of the party would be incommoded if they were to wait and undergo the rush and trample of the crowd round about. When this fact was pointed out to him, he yielded at once, though with a heavy heart, his eyes looking longingly towards the ring as we retreated out of the booth. We were scarcely clear of the place when we heard "God Save the Queen," played by the equestrian band, the signal that all was over. Our companion entertained us with scraps of the dialogue on our way home, precious crumbs of wit which he had brought away from that feast. He laughed over them again as we walked under the stars. He has them now, and takes them out of the pocket of his memory, and crunches a bit, and relishes it with a sentimental tenderness too, for he is, no doubt, back at school by this time. The holidays are over, and Dr. Birch's young friends have reassembled. Queer jokes, which caused a thousand simple mouths to grin. As the jaded Merriman uttered them to the old gentleman with the whip, some of the old folks in the audience, I dare say, indulged in reflections of their own. There was one joke I utterly forget it, but it began with Merriman saying what he had for dinner. He had mutton for dinner, at 1 o'clock, after which he had to come to business. And then came the point. Walter Juvenis Esquire, Rev. Dr. Birch's, Market Rodborough, if you read this, will you please send me a line, and let me know what was the joke Mr. Merriman made about having his dinner? You remember well enough. But do I want to know? Suppose a boy takes a favorite, long-cherished lump of cake out of his pocket, and offers you a bite? Merci. The fact is, I don't care much about knowing that joke of Mr. Merriman's. But whilst he was talking about his dinner, and his mutton, and his landlord, and his business, I felt a great interest about Mr. M. in private life, about his wife, lodgings, earnings, and general history, and I dare say, was forming a picture of those in my mind, wife cooking the mutton, children waiting for it, Merriman in his plain clothes, and so forth. During which contemplation the joke was uttered and laughed at, and Mr. M., resuming his professional duties, was tumbling over head and heels. Do not suppose I am going, sick at Eskimos, to indulge in moralities about buffoons, paint, motley, and mountebanking. Nay, prime ministers rehearse their jokes, opposition leaders prepare and polish them, tabernacle preachers must arrange them in their minds before they utter them. All I mean is that I would like to know any one of these performers thoroughly, and out of his uniform. That preacher, and why in his travels this and that point struck him, wherein lies his power of pathos, humor, eloquence. That minister of state, and what moves him, and how his private heart is working. I would only say that, at a certain time of life certain things cease to interest. But about some things, when we cease to care, what will be the use of life, sight, hearing? Poems are written, and we cease to admire. Lady Jones invites us, and we yawn. She ceases to invite us, and we are resigned. The last time I saw a ballet at the opera, it is many years ago, I fell asleep in the stalls, wagging my head in insane dreams, and I hope affording amusement to the company, while the feet of 500 nymphs were cutting flick-flacks on the stage at a few paces' distance. Ah, I remember a different state of things. Credite posteri. To see those nymphs' gracious powers, how beautiful they were. That leering, painted, shriveled, thin-armed, thick-ankled old thing, cutting dreary capers, coming thumping down on her board out of time, that an opera dancer? Pooh! My dear Walter, the great difference between my time and yours, who will enter life some 2 or 3 years hence, is that, now, the dancing women and singing women are ludicrously old, out of time, and out of tune. The paint is so visible, and the dinge and wrinkles of their wretched old cotton stockings, that I am surprised how anybody can like to look at them. And as for laughing at me for falling asleep, I can't understand a man of sense doing otherwise. In my time, a Le Bon Heur. In the reign of George IV. I give you my honor, all the dancers at the opera were as beautiful as ours. Even in William IV. Apostrophe's time, when I think of Duvernay prancing in as the Bayadere, I say it was a vision of loveliness such as mortal eyes can't see nowadays. How well I remember the tune to which she used to appear. Cale used to say to the Sultan, "My lord, a troop of those dancing and singing girls called Bayadere's approaches, and, to the clash of cymbals, and the thumping of my heart, and she used to dance. There has never been anything like it, never. There never will be." I laugh to scorn old people who tell me about your Noblet, your Montesu, your Vestris, your Paris at Saw, the senile twaddlers. And the impudence of the young men, with their music and their dancers of today. I tell you the women are dreary old creatures. I tell you one air in an opera is just like another, and they send all rational creatures to sleep. Ah, bronze-eyed Abegnus, thou lovely one. Ah, Caradoni, thou smiling angel. Ah, Malibran. Nay, I will come to modern times, and acknowledge that Lablake was a very good singer 30 years ago, though Porto was the boy for me, and then we had Ambrogetti, and Curioni, and Donzelli, a rising young singer. But what is most certain and lamentable is the decay of stage beauty since the days of George IV. Think of Sontag. I remember her in Otello and the Donna del Lago in 28. I remember being behind the scenes at the opera where numbers of us young fellows of fashion used to go, and seeing Sontag let her hair fall down over her shoulders previous to her murder by Donzelli. Young fellows have never seen beauty like that, heard such a voice, seen such hair, such eyes. Don't tell me. A man who has been about town since the reign of George IV. Ought he not to know better than you young lads who have seen nothing? The deterioration of women is lamentable, and the conceit of the young fellows more lamentable still, that they won't see this fact, but persist in thinking their time as good as ours. Bless me. When I was a lad, the stage was covered with angels, who sang, acted, and danced. When I remember the Adelphi, and the actresses there. when I think of Miss Chester, and Miss Love, and Mrs. Sherlock Sadler's Wells, and her 40 glorious pupils of the opera and Noblet, and the exquisite young Taglioni, and Pauline Leroux, and a host more. One much admired being of those days I confess I never cared for, and that was the chief male dancer, a very important personage then, with a bare neck, bare arms, a tunic, and a hat and feathers, who used to divide the applause with the ladies, and who has now sunk down a trapdoor forever. And this frank admission ought to show that I am not your mere twaddling laudator temperance act, I your old fogey who can see no good except in his own time. They say that claret is better nowadays, and cookery much improved since the days of my monarch of George IV. Pastry cookery is certainly not so good. I have often eaten half a crown's worth, including, I trust, ginger beer, at our school pastry cook's, and that is a proof that the pastry must have been very good, for could I do as much now? I passed by the pastry cook's shop lately, having occasion to visit my old school. It looked a very dingy old baker's. Misfortunes may have come over him, those penny tarts certainly did not look so nice as I remember them. But he may have grown careless as he has grown old. I should judge him to be now about 96 years of age, and his hand may have lost its cunning. Not that we were not great epicures. I remember how we constantly grumbled at the quantity of the food in our master's house, which on my conscience I believe was excellent and plentiful, and how we tried once or twice to eat him out of house and home. At the pastry cook's we may have overeaten ourselves. I have admitted half a crown's worth for my own part, but I don't like to mention the real figure for fear of perverting the present generation of boys by my monstrous confession.
We may have eaten too much, I say.
We did. But what then? The school apothecary was sent for. A couple of small globules at night, a trifling preparation of senna in the morning, and we had not to go to school, so that the draft was an actual pleasure. For our amusements, besides the games in vogue, which were pretty much in old times as they are now, except cricket, par example, and I wish the present youth joy of their bowling, and suppose Armstrong and Whitworth will bowl at them with light field pieces next, there were novels, I trouble you to find such novels in the present day. Oh, Scottish chiefs, didn't we weep over you? Oh, mysteries of Udolpho, didn't I and Briggs Minor draw pictures out of you, as I have said? Efforts, feeble indeed, but still giving pleasure to us and our friends. Say, old boy, draw us Vivaldi tortured in the Inquisition, or draw us Don Quixote and the windmills. You know, amateurs would say, two boys who had a love of drawing. Peregrine Pickle we liked, our fathers admiring it, and telling us the sly old boys, it was capital fun. But I think I was rather bewildered by it, though Roderick Random was and remains delightful. I don't remember having Sterne in the school library, no doubt because the works of that divine were not considered decent for young people. Ah, not against thy genius, O father of Uncle Toby and Trim, would I say a word in disrespect. But I am thankful to live in times when men no longer have the temptation to write so as to call blushes on women's cheeks, and with shame to whisper wicked allusions to honest boys. Then, above all, we had Walter Scott, the kindly, the generous, the pure, the companion of what countless delightful hours, the purveyor of how much happiness, the friend whom we recall as the constant benefactor of our youth. How well I remember the type, and the brownish paper of the old Duodecimo ales of my landlord. I have never dared to read the Irate, and the Ride of Lammermoor, or Ennilworth, from that day to this, because the finale is unhappy, and people die, and are murdered at the end. But Ivanhoe, and Linton Durward. Oh! For a half holiday, and a quiet corner, and one of those books again. Those books, and perhaps those eyes with which we read them, and, it may be, the brains behind the eyes. It may be the tart was good, but how fresh the appetite was. If the gods would give me the desire of my heart, I should be able to write a story which boys would relish for the next few dozen of centuries. The boy critic loves the story. Grown up, he loves the author who wrote the story. Hence the kindly tie is established between writer and reader, and lasts pretty nearly for life. I meet people now who don't care for Walter Scott, or the Arabian Nights. I am sorry for them, unless they in their time have found their romance or their charming Scheherazade. By the way, Walter, when you are writing, tell me who is the favorite novelist in the fourth form now? Have you got anything so good and kindly as dear Miss Edgeworth's Frank? It used to belong to a fellow's sisters generally, but though he pretended to despise it, and said, oh, stuff for girls, he read it, and I think there were one or two passages which would dry my eyes now, were I to meet with the little book. As for Thomas and Jeremiah, it is only my witty way of calling Tom and Jerry. I went to the British Museum the other day on purpose to get it. But somehow, if you will press the question so closely, on reperusal, Tom and Jerry is not so brilliant as I had supposed it to be. The pictures are just as fine as ever, and I shook hands with broadback Jerry Hawthorne and Corinthian Tom with delight, after many years' absence. But the style of the writing, I own, was not pleasing to me. I even thought it a little vulgar. Well, other writers have been considered vulgar, and as a description of the sports and amusements of London in the ancient times, more curious. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.